Saline tracked it in turn. She tracked it through the slumbering courtyards of the Louvre. It was oozing ichor from a wound, but it wasn't moving like a creature slinking off to nurse its wounds. Its giant pincers skittered at the cobblestones as it hesitated at corners, deciding which way to turn. This was a predator tracking its prey. The demon paused in the archway of the Louvre, at the foot of the Pont des Arts. A small pedestrian bridge stretched across the Seine, its railings crowded with lovers' locks. It was said that if a couple attached a lock to the Pont des Arts, their love would last forever. The bridge was almost deserted at this hour, except for one young couple, locked in an embrace, completely oblivious to the shack's demon slithering out of the shadows, pincers clicking together in eager anticipation. Celine always carried a misericord blade. Its narrow point was exactly what she needed to penetrate the insectoid demon's carapace. She hoped. "Gadriel," Celine whispered, naming a seraph blade. She crept behind the shack's demon, as steady and silent as it was. She, too, could be a predator. In one smooth, sure motion, she stabbed the misericord straight through the carapace, then slid the seraph blade into the wound she'd opened. The demon dissolved. It had all happened so swiftly, so quietly, that the couple on the bridge didn't even break from their embrace. They were too intent on each other to realize how close they'd come to being a demon's late-night snack. Saline lingered, trying to imagine it, standing on the bridge with someone who loved her. A man gazing so intently into her eyes that he wouldn't have noticed the world ending. But Celine's imagination gave out. Reality had caged her in. As long as she thought Stephen hadn't noticed her, she could fantasize about what might happen if he ever did. Now she knew. She could not unknow. Celine wiped and sheathed her blade, then crept closer to the couple, close enough to hear what they were saying. She was glamored, after all. So there was no danger in doing a little eavesdropping. What did a man say to the woman he loved when he thought no one else could hear? She might never find out if she waited for someone to say them to her. "I hate to say I told you so," the woman said. "But who knew he'd be so willing to trust a warlock? Who knew anyone would believe you were the long-lost descendant of some noble Shadowhunter line?" she said, then laughed. "Oh, wait, I knew. Admit it. Deep down, you knew it would work. You just didn't want it to." "Of course I didn't want it to." He touched her cheek impossibly gently. "I hate this. I hate leaving you here. It's not for long, and it's for the best, Jack. I promise."
"You'll come find me in L.A. as soon as it's taken care of. You swear?"
"In the shadow market, at our old place, I swear. As soon as I can be sure the trail's gone cold." She kissed him long and hard. When she pressed her hand to his cheek, Celine spotted the glint of a wedding band. "Rosemary, I don't want you anywhere near these people. It's not safe."
"But it's safe for you?"
"You know I'm right," she said. The man hung his head and tucked his hands into the pockets of his trench coat. It looked expensive, except for the giant gaping hole torn through the left side.
"Yeah."
"You ready?" He nodded, and she pulled a small bottle from her bag. "It's better work the way it's supposed to." She handed it to her husband, who uncorked it, swallowed its contents, and tossed it into the river. A moment later, he clutched his hands to his face and began to scream. Celine panicked. It wasn't her place to interfere, but she couldn't just stand there and watch as this woman murdered her.
"Jack, Jack, it's okay. You're okay."
She clung to him as the man moaned and shuddered and finally slumped quietly into her arms.
"I think it worked," he said.
When they backed away from each other, Celine gasped. Even in the dim light of the streetlight, she could see that his face had transformed. He had been a blonde with sparkling green eyes and sharp, chiseled features around the age of Stephen and nearly as handsome. Now he looked 10 years older, his face carved with worry lines, his hair mud-colored, his smile crooked.
"Hideous,"
the woman named Rosemary said approvingly. Then she kissed him again, just as desperately as before, as if nothing had changed.
"Now go." "You sure?"
"As sure as I am that I love you." The man fled into the night, his coat melting into the darkness.
"And ditch the trench,"
Rosemary called after him.
"It's too obvious."
"Never,"
He shouted back, and then he was gone. Rosemary sagged against the bridge and buried her face in her hands, so she didn't see the gargoyle behind her blink its eyes and swivel its stone snout in her direction. Céline suddenly remembered. The Pont des Arts had no gargoyles. This was a flesh and blood, a chiral demon, and it looked hungry. With a furious roar, the monstrous shadow peeled itself off the bridge and unfolded a set of huge bat-like wings that blotted out the night. It opened its jaw wide and bared razor-like teeth, then lunged straight for Rosemary's throat. With shocking speed, Rosemary hefted a sword and slashed. The demon screeched in pain, raking its talons against the metal blade with enough force to knock it from the woman's hands. Rosemary stumbled to the ground, and the demon seized its moment. It leapt onto her chest, immobilizing her beneath its massive wings, and hissed. Teeth. Neared flesh. "Serial!" Céline whispered and stabbed her seraph blade through the demon's neck. It yowled with pain and whirled toward her, its innards bursting through its hide even as it tried, in its last remaining moments, to attack. Rosemary heaved her sword and sliced off the creature's head, seconds before head and torso exploded into a cloud of dust. Satisfied, she collapsed backward, the wound in her shoulder bleeding freely. Céline could tell how much it hurt and how determined the woman was to reveal no pain. She knelt by her side. Rosemary flinched away. "Let me see. I can help." "I would never ask for help from a shadow hunter," the woman said bitterly.
"You didn't ask, and you're welcome."
The woman sighed and examined her bloody wound. She touched it gingerly, winced. "As long as you're here, you want to give me an Arazi?" It was obvious the woman was no mundane. Even a mundane with the sight couldn't have fought the way she did. But that didn't mean she could withstand an Arazi. No one but a shadow hunter could.
"Look, I don't really have the time to explain it, and I can't exactly go to the hospital and tell them I got gnawed on by a demon, can I?"
"If you know about Arazis, you know that only a shadow hunter can bear a rune," Céline said.
"I know." Rosemary met her gaze steadily.
She didn't bear the Voyant's rune, but the way she had moved, the way she had fought.
"Have you borne a rune before?" she asked hesitantly.
Rosemary smirked. "What do you think?"
"Who are you?"
"No one you need to worry about. You going to help or not?"
Céline withdrew her steely. Applying a rune to anyone who wasn't a shadow hunter meant probable death, certain agony.
She took a deep breath, then carefully applied steely to skin. Rosemary let out a relieved sigh.
"Are you going to tell me who sent a Shaxx demon after you?" Céline said. "And whether it was the same person who made sure an chiral demon was here to finish the job?"
"No. You going to tell me why you're wandering around in the middle of the night looking like someone just drowned your pet rock in the Seine?"
"No."
"Okay, then. And thank you."
"That guy who was here with you before."
"You mean the one you didn't see and won't say anything about ever if you know what's good for you?"
"You love him, and he loves you, right?"
Céline asked. "I guess he must, because there are some dangerous people out there looking for me," Rosemary said. "And he's done his best to make sure they think they're looking for him instead."
"I don't understand."
"And you don't have to. But yeah, he loves me. I love him. Why?"
She wanted to ask what that was like. How it felt.
She wanted also to extend the conversation. She was afraid to be alone again, stranded on this bridge between the endless black of river and sky.
"I just want to make sure you have someone to take care of you."
"You take care of each other, that's how it works. Speaking of which," she gave Céline an appraising look, "I'm in your debt now for helping me out with the demon and for keeping my secret."
"I didn't say I would."
"You will, and I don't believe in debts, so let me do you a favor."
"I don't need anything," Céline said, meaning,
"I don't need anything anyone can give me."
"I keep my eyes open and I see what's happening in the Shadowhunter world. You need more than you think you do. Most of all, you need to stay away from Valentine Morgenstern."
Céline stiffened.
"What do you know about Valentine?"
"I know that you're just his type, young and impressionable, and I know that he can't be trusted. I pay attention. You should too. He's not telling you everything, I know that."
She looked over Céline's shoulder and her eyes widened.
"Someone's coming. You should get out of here." Celine turned around. A silent brother was gliding along the left bank, nearing the edge of the bridge. There was no way of knowing if it was the same one she'd met in the shadow market, but she couldn't risk running into him again. Not after what she'd told him. It was too humiliating. "Remember," Rosemary said, "Valentine is not to be trusted." "And why should I trust you?"
"No reason at all," Rosemary said. Without another word, she strode down the bridge toward the silent brother. The sky was pinking. The endless night had finally given way to dawn.
"I had expected to find your husband on this bridge." But even as he formed the words, Brother Zacharias sensed their untruth. He had trusted a man he knew could not be trusted. He had let his sympathies for the Herondale line, his desire to believe there remained some bond between the Carstairs and the Herondales, even though this man was barely a Herondale and Zachariah was barely a Carstairs, cloud his judgment, and now it was Jack Crow who might bear the consequences.
"He's not coming, and you're never going to see him again, Shadow Hunter, so I suggest you not bother to look."
"I understand that the Shadow Hunters have given your family every reason not to trust us, but..."
"Don't take it personally. I don't trust anyone," she said. "It's how I've managed to stay alive."
She was stubborn and rude, and Brother Zachariah couldn't help but like her.
"I mean, if I was going to trust someone, it wouldn't be a cult of violent fundamentalists who get a kick out of executing their own. But like I said, I don't trust anyone.
Except Jack Crow."
"That's not his name anymore."
"Whatever name he chooses, he will always be a Herondale."
She laughed, and when she did, her face took on a strangely familiar cast.
Familiar in the way that Jack Crow's had never been.
"You don't know nearly as much as you think you do, Shadow Hunter."
Brother Zachariah reached into his robe and pulled out the heron necklace he bought from the shadow market. The necklace, he remembered, that Crow had sold without his wife's permission or knowledge, as a man might do if it were not truly his to sell. The pendant glittered in the dawn light. Zachariah marked her surprise and offered the chain. She opened her palm and allowed him to place the pendant gently in her possession. Something deep in her seemed to settle as her hand wrapped around the heron charm, as if she had lost some essential piece of her soul, and now it was returned to her.
"A pigeon?" She raised her eyebrows.
"A heron. Perhaps you recognize it?"
"Why would I?"
"Because I purchased it from your husband." Her lips were pressed together in a thin, tight line. Her hand had formed a fist around the chain. It was clear the child at the booth had spoken the truth. She didn't know the pendant had been for sale.
"Then why give it to me?"
She could pretend a lack of interest, but Zachariah wondered what she would say if he asked for it back. He suspected he would have a fight on his hands. "Because I have a feeling it belongs to you and to your family." She stiffened, and Brother Zachariah marked the minute twitch of her hand, as if instinctively reaching for a weapon. She had sharp instincts, but also self-control. And arrogance, grace, and loyalty, and the capacity for great love. And a laugh that could light up the sky. He had come to Paris looking for the lost Herondale. And he had found her.
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"You are the Herondale, not your husband. You, the lost heir to a noble line of warriors."
"I'm nobody," she snapped. "Nobody of interest to you, at least."
"I could reach into your mind and confirm the truth." She flinched. Zachariah didn't have to read her mind to understand her panic or her welling self-doubt as she scrambled to figure out how he had seen through the ruse. "But I would not trespass on your secrets. I want only to help you."
"My parents told me everything I need to know about the Shadow Hunters," she said,
and Brother Zachariah understood this was as close to an admission as he was going to get.
"Your precious little clave, your law." She spit out the last word like it was poison.
"I am not here as a representative of the clave. They have no idea I've come to you, or even that you exist. I have my own reasons for finding you, for wanting to protect you. And they are?
I would not trespass on your secrets, and I would ask that you not trespass on mine. Know only that I owe a great debt to your family. The bonds holding me to the Herondales run deeper than blood.
Well, that's nice of you and all, but no one asked you to pay any debts, Rosemary said. Jack and I are doing just fine, taking care of each other, and that's what we'll keep doing.
It was clever of you to make it seem as if your husband was the one I sought, but...
It was clever of Jack. People underestimate him, and they pay for it.
But if I could penetrate your ruse, others who seek you may as well, and they are more dangerous than you know.
These others you talk about butchered my parents.
Rosemary's face betrayed no expression.
Jack and I have been on the run for years. Trust me, I know exactly how dangerous this is, and I know exactly how dangerous it is to trust a stranger, even a stranger with psychic ninja powers and a deeply weird fashion sense.
One of the things Brother Zachariah had learned in the Silent Brotherhood was the power of acceptance. Sometimes it was stronger to recognize an unwinnable fight and accept defeat, the better to begin laying groundwork for the next battle. Though this was not a battle, he reminded himself. You could not war for a person's trust. You could only earn it. Your Heron necklace now has an enchantment on it. If you encounter trouble you cannot face on your own, you need only summon me and I will come.
If you think you can track us through this thing...
Your husband suggested that the only way to earn trust is by offering it. I will not try to find you if you prefer not to be found. But with this pendant, you can always find me. I trust you will summon me for help, if and when you need. Please trust that I will always answer.
And who are you, exactly?
You may call me Brother Zachariah.
I could. But if I end up in this hypothetical situation where I need my life saved by some bloodthirsty monk, I'd rather know his actual name.
I was once. It had been so long he almost didn't feel entitled to the name. But there was a deep, nearly human pleasure in allowing himself to claim it. I was once known as James Carstairs. Jem.
So who will you summon when you encounter trouble you can't face on your own, Jem?
She fastened the pendant around her neck, and Zachariah felt a sliver of relief. At least he'd accomplished that much. I don't anticipate that.
Then you're not paying attention.
She touched him on the shoulder then, unexpectedly, and with unexpected gentleness.
Thank you for trying, she said. It's a start.
Then he was watching her walk away. Brother Zachariah watched the water stream beneath the bridge. He thought about that other bridge, in another city, where once a year he returned to remember the man he'd once been, and the dreams that man had once had. At the far end of the Pont des Arts, a young street musician opened a violin case and raised the instrument to his chin. For a moment, Zachariah thought he was imagining it, that he had conjured up a fantasy of his former self. But as he drew closer, because he could not stay away, he realized the musician was a girl. She was young, no more than 14 or 15, her hair swept up beneath a newsboy cap, a neat, old-fashioned bow tie at the collar of her white blouse. She bowed the strings and began to play a haunting melody. Brother Zachariah recognized it, the Bartok violin concerto that had been written well after Jem Carstairs had put down his violin. Silent Brothers played no music. They didn't listen to music either, not in the ordinary way. But even with their senses sealed off to mortal pleasures, they still heard. Jem heard. He was glamored. The musician must have assumed she was alone. There was no audience for her music, no possibility of payment. She wasn't playing for spare change, but for her own pleasure. She faced the water, the sky. This was a song to welcome the sun. Distantly, he remembered the soft pressure of the chin rest. He remembered his fingertips capering across the strings. He remembered the dance of the bow. He remembered how, sometimes, it had felt like the music was playing him. There was no music in the silent city. There was no sun, no dawn. There was only dark. There was only quiet.
Paris was a city that luxuriated in the senses, food, wine, art, romance. Everywhere was a reminder of what he'd lost, the pleasures of a world no longer his. He had learned to live with the loss. It was harder when he immersed himself in the world like this, but it was bearable. This was something else, though. The nothing he felt as he listened to the melody, watched the bow waltz up and down the strings, the great hollow it opened inside him, echoing only with the past, that made him feel utterly, dismally inhuman. The longing he felt to truly hear, to want, to feel, that made him feel almost alive. "Come home," the brothers whispered in his mind. "It is time." Over the years, as he'd gained more control, Brother Zachariah had learned how to isolate himself from the voices of his brothers when need be. It was a strange thing, the brotherhood. Most assumed it was a lonely, solitary life. And it was, indeed, solitary. But he was never truly alone. The brotherhood was always there, on the edge of his awareness, watching, waiting. Brother Zachariah needed only extend a hand, and the brotherhood would reclaim him. "Soon," he promised them. "But not yet. I have more business here." He was more silent brother than not, but he was still less silent brother than the others. It was a strange liminal space, one that allowed him a modicum of privacy, and a desire for it that his brothers had long since abandoned. Zachariah shut himself off from them for the moment. He felt a deep regret over his failure here, but it was good, it was human to feel regret. And he wanted to savor it, all on his own. Or maybe not all on his own. There was, in fact, one more piece of business before he could return to the Silent City. He needed to explain himself to the one person who cared as much about the Herondales as he did. He needed Tessa. Celine didn't go to Valentine's apartment intending to break in. That would have been madness. And anyway, after a night and day of blindly wandering the city, she was too sleep-deprived to form clear intentions of anything. She simply followed a whim. She wanted the certainty that settled over her in Valentine's presence, the power he had to make her believe, not just in him, but in herself. After her strange encounter on the bridge, she'd considered going back to the flat in the Marais. She knew Stephen and Robert should be apprised of the unexpected demon activity, the possibility of a rogue shadow hunter causing trouble and spreading suspicion about the circle. She couldn't face them. Let them worry about what had become of her. Or not worry. She no longer cared. At least she was trying very hard not to care. She'd spent the day in the Louvre, haunting galleries that none of the tourists cared to see. Old Etruscan masks and Mesopotamian coins. She spent hours there when she was younger, blending in with the hordes of school children. It was easy, when you were a child, to go unseen. The challenge, Celine understood now, was to be seen, and once seen, to endure judgment. She couldn't stop thinking about the couple on the bridge, the way they'd gazed at each other, the way they'd touched each other with so much care and so much need. Nor could she stop thinking about the woman's warning about Valentine. Celine was certain she could trust Valentine with her life. But if she'd been so wrong about Stephen, how could she know for sure she was right about anything? Valentine was staying in opulent quarters in the 6th arrondissement, down the street from a famous chocolatier and maiserie where the custom hats cost more than most people spent on rent. She knocked loudly. When no one answered, it was easy enough to pick the lock. "I am breaking into Valentine Morgenstern's apartment," she thought, bewildered by herself. It didn't seem quite real. The apartment was elegant, almost regal. Walls draped with gold fleur-de-lis, furniture covered with velvet. Plush rugs dotted the gleaming hardwood floors, heavy golden curtains dimmed the light. The room's only anachronism was a large glass case in the center, inside of which lay Dominique de Foix, bound, beaten, and unconscious. Before she could decide what to do, there was a sound of a key rattling in the lock. The doorknob turned. Without thinking, Celine dove behind the thick curtains. She held herself very, very still. From her hiding spot, she couldn't see Valentine pacing back and forth across the living room, but she could hear everything she needed to.
"Wake up," he snapped. There was a pause, a rustling, and then a woman's yelp of pain. "Help us, demons," he said, sounding halfway between amused and enraged. "Really?"
"You told me to make it look real," Dominique whined.
"Yes, I told you to make it look real, not endanger them."
"You also told me you'd pay, but here I am, in some kind of cage, with an empty wallet and a couple unseemly lumps on my head."
Valentine sighed heavily, as if this were all an irritating imposition on his time.
"You told them exactly what we agreed upon, yes? And signed the confession?"
"Isn't that what the little brats told you when they dumped me here? So how about you pay me for my services and we can forget this ever happened?"
"Gladly."
There was a strange sound, one that Celine couldn't place. Then a smell, one that she could. Burnt flesh. Valentine cleared his throat.
"You can come out now, Celine."
She froze. Didn't so much catch her breath as lose the ability to breathe.
"Not very good at subterfuge lately, are we? Come on now, show yourself."
He clapped his hands together sharply as if summoning a pet.
"No more games."
Celine stepped out from behind the curtains, feeling like a fool.
"You knew I was here? The whole time?"
"You would be surprised what all I know, Celine."
Valentine smiled coldly. As always, he was dressed in all black, which made his white blonde hair seem to glow with pale fire. Celine supposed that by objective standards, Valentine was just as handsome as Stephen. But it was impossible to think of him that way. He was handsome the way a statue was handsome, perfectly sculpted, unyielding as stone. Sometimes at the academy, Celine would watch him with Jocelyn, wondering at the way a single touch from her could melt his ice. Once Celine had come upon them in an embrace and had watched from the shadows as they lost themselves in each other. When they broke from the kiss, Valentine had raised a hand to Jocelyn's cheek in an impossibly tender touch, and his expression, as he gazed at his first and only love, was almost human. There was no trace of that in him now. He opened his arms wide as if welcoming her to make herself at home in the opulent living room. The cage at the center was empty, except for a smoldering pile of black lace and leather. Dominique Dufoix was gone. Valentine followed her gaze.
"She was a criminal," he said. "I simply expedited the inevitable sentence."
There were rumors about Valentine, about the change that had come over him when his father was killed. Dark whispers about the cruelties he carried out not just on trespassing downworlders, but on anyone who crossed him. Anyone who questioned him.
"You look worried, Celine. Even afraid."
"No," she said quickly.
"It's almost as if you think breaking into my apartment to spy on me might draw some kind of nasty consequence."
"I wasn't spying. I was just..."
He favored her with a smile then, so warm, so sunny, that she felt ridiculous for having been so afraid.
"Would you settle for tea? And maybe some biscuits? You look like you haven't eaten in a year."
He set out a bounty, not just tea and biscuits, but a sliced baguette, fresh chèvre, and a small pot of honey, a bowl of blueberries that tasted like they'd just been plucked from the branch. Celine hadn't known she was hungry until the taste of honey hit her tongue. She realized she was ravenous. They made polite Paris small talk. Their favorite cafes, their preferred picnic spots, the best crepe stand, the relative merits of the Orsay and the Pompidou. Then Valentine took a hearty bite of cheese-smeared baguette and said almost cheerfully,
"You know, of course, that the others think you're weak and not particularly bright."
Celine almost choked on a blueberry.
"If it were up to most of the circle, you wouldn't be in it. Fortunately, this isn't a democracy. They think they know you, Celine, but they don't know the half of it, do they?"
Slowly she shook her head. No one knew her, not really. "I, on the other hand, believed in you. I trusted you.
And you repay this trust with suspicion?
I really didn't.
Of course you had no suspicions. You just thought you'd pay a social call behind my curtains while I was out.
Okay. Oui. I was suspicious.
See? You are smart.
That smile again, warm and approving like she'd fulfilled his intentions.
And what is it you discovered about me with your intrepid investigation?
There was no point in pretense. And Celine was almost as curious as she was terrified, so she told the truth as she'd surmised it.
Dominique Dufoy wasn't in business with two shadow hunters, she was in business with you. You're trying to set someone up, and you're using us to do it.
Us?
Me, Robert, Stephen.
Robert and Stephen, yes. I'm indeed using them. But you're here, aren't you? You're getting the full story.
I am?
If you want it.
Celine had not had the kind of parents who read her fairy tales, but she'd read enough of them herself to know the cardinal rule of these stories. Be careful what you wish for. And like every shadow hunter, she knew all the stories are true.
I want to know, she said.
He told her she was right. He was framing two shadow hunters, innocent of these crimes but guilty of a much larger one, standing in the circle's way.
They're bogged down in tradition. They're beholden to the Clave's corruption, and they're dead set on destroying me. So I acted first.
He used the warlock to plant evidence, he admitted. Now he would use Stephen and Robert as witnesses to her confession.
Since she is, unfortunately, no longer able to testify.
What about the mortal sword? Celine asked. Aren't you worried what will happen when the accused shadow hunters are interrogated?
Valentine tisked, as if disappointed that she hadn't jumped to the correct conclusion.
It's very unfortunate they'll never make it that far. I happen to know these two shadow hunters will make an escape attempt during their transport to the Silent City. They'll be killed in the ensuing chaos. Tragic.
The words sat heavy between them. Celine tried to process it. Valentine wasn't just setting up two shadow hunters, two innocent shadow hunters. He was planning to murder them in cold blood. This was an unthinkable crime for which the law would demand death.
Why are you telling me this? She said, trying to keep her voice from trembling. What makes you think I won't turn you in, unless...
Unless he had no intention of letting her leave this apartment alive.
A man who could kill two shadow hunters in cold blood could presumably kill a third. Everything in her said that she should leap to her feet, draw her weapon, fight her way out of here, run straight to the Paris Institute, tell them everything. Stop this, stop him, before he went any further.
Valentine watched her calmly, palms up on the table as if to say, "Your move." She didn't move. The Verlac family who ran the Paris Institute were friends with her parents. More than once, a Verlac had sought out her hiding place and dumped her back home. That first time she'd pleaded for asylum at the Institute, where all shadow hunters were supposedly guaranteed a safe home. Celine was told she was too young to make such requests, too young to know what safe meant. She was told her parents loved her, and she should stop causing them so much trouble. She owed these people nothing. Valentine, on the other hand, had singled her out, given her a mission, a family. She owed him everything. He leaned toward her, reached out his hand. She willed herself not to flinch. He touched her neck, lightly, where the achiral demon had scratched her.
You're hurt.
It's nothing, she said.
And you were limping.
I'm fine.
If you need another Arazi.
I'm fine.
He nodded like she'd confirmed a suspicion.
Yes, you prefer it this way, don't you?
What way?
In pain.
Now Celine flinched.
I do not, she insisted. That would be sick.
But do you know why you prefer it? Why you chase the pain?
She had never understood this about herself, only knew it in the deep, wordless way you knew your most essential truth. There was something about pain that made her feel more solid, more real, more in control. Sometimes the pain felt like the only thing she could control.
You covet pain because you know it makes you strong, Valentine said.
It felt like he had given name to her nameless soul.
You know why I understand you better than the rest of them, because we're the same. We learned early, didn't we? Cruelty, harshness, pain. No one shielded us from the realities of life, and that made us strong. Most people, they're ruled by fear. They flee the specter of pain, and that makes them weak. You and I, Celine, we know the only way through is to face pain, to invite the cruelty of the world and master it. Celine had never thought of herself this way, hard and strong. She'd certainly never dared think of herself as anything like Valentine.
That's why I wanted you in the circle. Robert, Stephen, the others? They're still just boys. Children playing at adult games. They haven't yet been tested. They will be, but not yet. You and I, though, we're special. We haven't been children for a long time. No one had ever called her strong. No one had ever called her special.
Things are accelerating, Valentine said. I need to know who's with me and who's not.
So you can see why I told you the truth about this, he gestured to the singed heap of warlock clothes,
situation.
It's a test, she guessed. A loyalty test?
It's an opportunity, he corrected her, to invite you into my confidence and reward you for yours. My proposal, you stay silent about what you've learned here, and allow events to proceed as I intend, and I will deliver you Stephen Herondale on a silver platter.
What?
I told you, Celine. I know things, I know you, and I can give you what you want, if you really want it.
Be careful what you wish for, she thought again.
But oh, she wished for Stephen. Even knowing what he thought of her, even with his mocking laughter ringing in her ears, even believing what Valentine said, that she was strong and Stephen was weak, even knowing what she knew to be true, that Stephen did not love her and never would, she wished for him, always and forever.
Or you can leave this apartment, run to the Clave, tell them whatever story you like, save these two innocent shadow hunters, and lose the only family who's ever truly cared about you, Valentine said. The choice is yours.
Tessa Gray breathed in the city that had once briefly but indelibly been her home. How many nights had she stood on this same bridge, gazing at the hulking shadow of Notre Dame, the rippling waters of the Seine, the proud scaffolding of the Eiffel Tower, all of it, Paris's heartbreaking beauty, blurred by her ceaseless tears. How many nights had she searched the river for her ageless reflection, imagining the seconds, days, years, centuries she might live, and every one of them in a world without will? No, not imagining, because it had been unimaginable. Unimaginable, but here she was, more than 50 years later, still living, still without him, heart forever broken yet still beating, still strong, still capable of love. She'd fled to Paris after he died, stayed until she was strong enough to face her future, and hadn't been back since. On the face of things, the city hadn't changed. But then, on the face of things, neither had she. You couldn't trust the face of things to show you their truth. You didn't have to be a shapeshifter to know that.
I'm so sorry, Tessa. I had her, and I let her go.
Even after all these years, she wasn't used to it. This cold version of Jem's voice speaking inside her mind, at once so intimate and so far away. His hand rested on the railing bare inches from hers. She could have touched him. He wouldn't pull away, not from her. But his skin would be so cold, so dry, like stone. Everything about him like stone.
You found her. That's what we set out to do, right?
This was never about bringing the lost Herondale back to the Shadow Hunter world, or choosing a path for her. There was comfort in the familiar weight of the jade pendant around her neck, warm against her chest. She still wore it, every day, as she had since the day Jem gave it to her, more than a century before. He didn't know.
What you say is true, but still, it does not seem right for a Herondale to be in danger while we do nothing. I fear I failed you, Tessa, that I have failed him. Between her and Jem, there was only ever one him. We found her for Will, and you know Will would want her to choose for herself, just like he did. If he had still been Holy Jem, she would have put her arms around him. She would have let him feel, in her embrace, her breath, her heartbeat, how impossible it was for him to fail either her or Will. But he was both Jem and not Jem, both himself and unfathomably other, and she could only stand beside him, assure him with useless words that he had done enough. He'd warned her once what would happen as he became less himself, more silent brother, promised her that the transformation would never be complete. When I no longer see the world with my human eyes, I will still be, in some part, the Jem you knew, he had said. I will see you with the eyes of my heart. When she looked at him now, his sealed eyes and lips, his cold face, when she breathed in his inhuman smell, like paper, like stone, like nothing that had ever lived or loved, she tried to remember this. She tried to believe that some part of him was still in there, seeing her and longing to be seen. It got harder every year. There had been moments over the decades when the Jem she remembered truly broke through. Once, during one of the mundane world's innumerable wars, they had even stolen a kiss. And almost more. Jem had pushed her away before things could go too far. After that, he'd held himself more distant from Tessa, almost as if afraid of what might happen if he let himself near the brink. That embrace, which she thought about almost every day, was more than 40 years ago now. And every year, he seemed a little less Jem, a little less human. She feared he was forgetting himself, piece by piece. She could not lose him, not him too. She would be his memory. I met a girl here, he said, in love with a Herondale. She imagined she could hear a faint smile in his voice. Did she remind you of anyone? Tessa teased. Her love seemed to cause her great pain. I would have liked to help her. It was one of the things she loved about him, his abiding desire to help anyone in need. This was something the Silent Brotherhood could not strip away. I used to come to this bridge all the time, you know, when I lived in Paris, after Will. It is very peaceful here, and very beautiful. She wanted to tell him that wasn't it. She hadn't come for the peace or the beauty. She'd come because this bridge reminded her of the Black Friars Bridge, the bridge that belonged to her and Jem. She'd come because standing here, suspended between land and water, her hands tight on the iron railing, her face raised to the sky, reminded her of Jem. The bridge reminded her that there was still someone in the world that she loved, that even if half of her heart was gone forever, the other half was still here. Unreachable, maybe, but here. She wanted to tell him, but she couldn't. It wouldn't be fair. He would be asking something of Jem that he couldn't deliver. And the world had already asked far too much of him. He would have hated it, the idea of a Herondale out there somewhere who thinks she can't trust the Shadowhunters, who thinks we're the villains. He might well have understood. It was true, Will himself had been raised to distrust the Shadowhunters. He knew, better than most, how harshly the Glaive treated those who turned their backs on it. He would have been enraged to learn about this lost branch of his family at the thought of the Glaive attempting to execute a mother and child for a father's sins. Tessa feared for the safety of this lost Herondale. But just as much, she longed to persuade her that some Shadowhunters could be trusted. She wanted to make this young woman understand that they weren't all hard and unfeeling, that some of them were like Will. I get so angry at them sometimes. The Shadowhunters who came before us, the mistakes they made. Think how many lives have been ruined by the choices of an earlier generation. She was thinking of Tobias Herondale, but also Axel Mortmain, whose parents had been murdered in front of him, and Aloysius Starkweather, who'd paid for that sin with his granddaughter's life. She was thinking even of her own brother, whose mother had refused to claim him as her own, who might have found his way to being a better man had he been better loved. It would be unjust to blame the past for choices made in the present, nor can we justify present choices by invoking the sins of the past. You and I know that better than most. Jem, too, had seen his parents murdered in front of him. Jem had endured a life of pain, but he'd never let himself be warped by it, never turned to revenge or vindictiveness. And Tessa had been conceived as a demonic tool, literally. She could have chosen to accept this fate. She could have chosen to flee the shadow world altogether, return to the mundane life she'd once known and pretend she did not see the darkness. Or she could have claimed that darkness as her own. She'd chosen a different path. They both had. "We always have a choice," Jem said, and for once, the voice in her mind sounded like him, warm and close. "It's not always the choice we would want, but it's a choice nonetheless. The past happens to us, but we choose our future. We can only help that our lost Herondale ultimately chooses to save herself."
"That's the best hope for any of us, I suppose."
Jem slid his hand across the railing and rested it atop hers. It was, as she knew it would be, cold, inhuman. But it was also Jem, flesh and blood, undeniably alive. And where there was life, there was hope. Maybe not now. Not yet. But someday. They could still have their future. She chose to believe it. The Church of Saint-Germain-des-Prés was founded in 558 AD. The original abbey was built on the ruins of an ancient Roman temple, then destroyed 2 centuries later in a Norman siege. Rebuilt in the 10th century AD, the church has now endured, in one form or another, for a millennium. The Merovingian kings are buried in its tombs, as is the torn-out heart of John II Casimir Vasa and the headless body of René Descartes. Most mornings, the abbey saw a steady trickle of tourists and observant locals wandering through its apse, lighting candles, bowing heads, whispering prayers to whoever might be listening. But this particular drizzly August morning, a sign on the door indicated the church was closed to the public. Inside, the Paris conclave had assembled. Shadow hunters from all across France listened solemnly to charges lodged against two of their own. Jules and Lisette Montclair stood silently, heads bowed, as Robert Lightwood and Stephen Herondale testified to their crimes. Their daughter, Celie Montclair, was not called upon to speak. She had, of course, not been present for the warlock's revelation of her parents' crimes. The scene played out as if Valentine had scripted it himself, and like everyone else present, Celine did exactly as Valentine intended. Nothing. Inside, she was at war with herself, furious at Valentine for making her complicit in her parents' destruction. Furious with herself for sitting silently as their fates were sealed. More furious at her own instinct for mercy. After all, her parents had never shown any to her. Her parents had done their best to teach her that mercy was weakness and cruelty was strength. So she steeled herself to be strong. Told herself this wasn't personal. This was about protecting the circle. If Valentine believed this was the righteous way forward, then this was the only way forward. She watched her parents quaver with fear under the steely eye of the Inquisitor, and she remembered the two of them backing away from her, ignoring her cries, closing her into darkness. And she said nothing. She sat very still, head lowered, and endured. They had taught her that too. The Shadow Hunters of France all knew Celine, or thought they did. That sweet and obedient daughter of the Provençal countryside. They knew how devoted she was to her parents. Such a dutiful daughter. She would, of course, inherit their estate. Celine bore the weight of the stares with dignity. She did not acknowledge the pitying looks. She kept her eyes on the floor when the judgment was issued and so did not see the horror on her parents' faces. She did not watch them placed in the custody of the Silent Brothers, to be transported to the Silent City. She did not expect them to survive long enough to face the mortal sword. She did not speak to Robert or Stephen, and let them believe this was because they had just consigned her parents to death. Valentine caught up with Celine just outside the church. He offered her Nutella crepe.
"From the stand across from Les Deux Magots," he said.
"Your favorite, right?" She shrugged, but took what he had to offer. The first bite, warm chocolate hazelnut, sweet pastry, was as perfect as ever. Made her feel like a child again. Sometimes it was difficult to believe she had ever been young.
"You could have told me," she said, "and ruined the surprise."
"Those are my parents."
"Indeed."
"And you've killed them."
"They're still alive, last I checked," Valentine said. "They could probably stay that way with a word from you,
but I didn't hear it." "You took a pretty big risk, not telling me the whole story, expecting me to let them go."
"Did I?"
he said. "Or did I simply know you well enough to know exactly what you would choose? To know I was doing you a favor?" He met her eyes. She could not look away. For the first time, she didn't want to.
"You don't have to admit it, Celine. Just know that I know. You're not alone in that."
He saw her. He understood. It was as if a muscle she'd been clenching her entire life finally released.
"A deal's a deal, though," he said. "Even if you got more than you bargained for, Stephen is all yours, assuming that's still what you want."
"How exactly would you make that happen?" she asked, clear now on exactly what Valentine was capable of. You wouldn't hurt him, would you?" Valentine looked disappointed in her.
"Stephen is my closest friend, my most trusted lieutenant. The fact that you would even ask that makes me question your loyalty, Celine." "Do you want me questioning your loyalty?"
She shook her head. Then that warm, buttery smile broke over his face again. She couldn't tell whether this was the real Valentine breaking through or the mask dropping back over his face.
"On the other hand, it would be foolish of you not to ask. And as we've discussed, there's nothing foolish in you, no matter what people might think."
"So, your answer? No.
I swear to you, on the angel, I will cause Stephen no harm in the enactment of this agreement."
"And no threat of harm?"
"Do you think so little of yourself that you assume a man would need to be threatened with harm before he could love you?"
She didn't answer. She didn't need to. He could surely read it all over her face.
"Stephen is with the wrong woman," Valentine told her almost gently. "Deep down, he knows that. I'll simply make this as clear to him as it is to us, and the rest will be as easy as falling off a cliff. You need only relax and let gravity do its work. Don't be afraid to reach for the things you really want, Celine. It's beneath you."
What she really wanted. It wasn't too late to speak up, to save her parents. Or she could keep her word and keep his secret. She could let her parents pay for what they'd done to her, for the lattice of scars on her skin and her heart, for the ice in her blood. If she was the kind of daughter who could consign her parents to death, then they had no one to blame but themselves. But that didn't mean she had to accept the entire bargain. Even if she stayed silent, she could walk away, away from Valentine, now that she knew what he was capable of. Away from Stephen, now that she knew what he thought of her. She could close the door on the past. Start again. She could choose a life without pain, without suffering or fear. But who would she be without pain? What was strength if not the endurance of suffering?
"There is nothing more painful than love denied," the strange silent brother had told her. "A love that cannot be requited. I can think of nothing more painful than that."
If Valentine said he could give her Stephen Herondale, he meant it. Celine did not doubt this. He could do anything, and that included finding a way to force Stephen Herondale into her life and her arms. But even Valentine could not make Stephen love her. To have Stephen would mean not having him. It would mean knowing in every moment, every embrace, that he wanted someone else.
it would mean a lifetime of longing for the one thing she could not have. The Silent Brother was wise and spoke the truth. There could be no greater pain than that.
Take your time, Valentine said. It's a big choice.
I don't need time, she told Valentine.
I want it. I want Stephen.
It didn't feel like choosing, because it was the only choice she had.
Ghosts of the Shadow Market, Book 6, The Wicked Ones, was written by Cassandra Clare and Robin Wasserman, and read by Emily Bett Rickards. It was recorded at Cosmic Sound in Vancouver. Editing and post-production by Steven Strassman. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producers were Aaron Larson and Elliot Rombach. Ghosts of the Shadow Market, Book 6, The Wicked Ones, was produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also by Cassandra Clare from Simon & Schuster Audio. Ghosts of the Shadow Market, Book 5, A Deeper Love. Read by Kiersey Clemens.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.